We continue our journey, and we're going to be focusing in this reflection on perhaps John of the Cross's most beautiful poem, certainly his shortest and most intense, The Living Flame of Love. There was a woman in one of the Spanish, he wrote it while he was a deputy provincial, and during that period, we're told, he travelled 8,600 miles from monastery to monastery. It was an exceptionally busy time of his life. There was a woman called Anna, whose name is there, who was a lay woman. Her husband and only child, a daughter, had died some 3 years before she met John of the Cross. She met him because she opened her house to the nuns while they were searching for a convent. And they struck up a very intimate relationship, really, which went all through his life. And in one of the break moments in his busy tearing around, if you could call it that, he had a couple of weeks and he came in and he wrote this poem straight off, really. And they tell me it's his most relaxed and most intense writing. Ian Matthew writes, John's prayer, that's his prayer, his poem, which expresses the prayer, and his prose, which unfolds the theme and tries to explain it as well. He did it under pressure. He didn't like trying to comment on poetry. And they tell me it's not that good and probably failed to do it too well. Because how do you do it except by having another poem? So, but all of them, according to Ian Matthew, glow with consistent heat. His words bring us as close as words can to the reality of John of the Cross's relationship with God, the depths of his spirit unveiled in this brief four-stanza. In his commentary, one of the things John of the Cross writes, no words have been invented for the works of God in the soul. The only language to cope with them is acceptance for oneself, experience, joy, and silence. But we can thank God that out of that silence he dashed off a poem, which is, well, they say John of the Cross is the best lyric poet in the Spanish language. So he's a very gifted poet. In the flame, says Ian Matthew, John is most himself. He's confident, close, consistent and hushed. If so, his witness to God is here least protected, and we're ready to hear this now first in the poem. And Ian Matthew continues, John shows his indebtedness to secular love poetry and to the traditional understanding of the Song of Songs as the love song of Yahweh for Israel, or the Lamb for his church, of Christ for the soul. This points to an organic link between human and divine love, for married love contains within itself a reality beyond itself. We talk about the sacrament, don't we? It is so sacred that it derives from and points to the love of Christ for humankind. And in the light of John's ballads, one could say for creation, as we saw earlier. And this is so good, this bit of Ian Matthew. The point is, so we're going to look at the poem in a minute, but the point is that John said it that he said it from his life experience. Many dreadful aspects to it. And right at the end, they lied about him. They tried to get rid of him. His own order, I mean, even the Discalced Carmelites. So he had a very difficult life as far as human acceptance goes. So, but he said it, and that it's possible to relate to God in the way that he now describes. So let's want it. I'll read it to you first, then I'll play some music. Flame, alive, compelling, yet tender past all telling, reaching the secret center of my soul. Since now evasion's over, finish your work, my lover. Break the last thread, wound me, make me whole. Burn that is for my healing, wound of delight past feeling. Ah, gentle hand, whose touch is a caress. Foretaste of heaven conveying, and every debt repaying, slaying, you give me life for death distress. O lamps of fire, bright burning, with splendid brilliance, turning deep caverns of my soul to pools of light. Once shadowed, dim, unknowing, now their strange newfound glowing gives warmth and radiance for my love's delight. Ah, gentle and so loving. You were within me, proving that you are there in secret and alone. Your fragrant breathing stills me. Your grace, your glory fills me. So tenderly, your love becomes my own.
Thank you. once obscured and blind, are now leading in the warmth and the passion of your love. Yet gently your hand does wound as you bend through the veil of my temple. Come and take this life that I give, so that I might come to live in this our dying. My soul to its deepest inner heart without
pressure. Commenting on the teaching and writing of John of the Cross, Ian Matthew says, "All the initiative belongs to the other." We all know how key that is, but it's absolutely vital. This is not something I can do, or you can do, or we can organize, or have a method of achieving. All the initiative belongs to the other. What we find filling John's mind is a God who is supremely active. "You," comments Ian Matthew, "you are piercing, repaying, slaying, giving life, waking, breathing. You," God of course, "you did seem oppressive, but it was you who seemed it. You may tear the veil, but it has to be you. If my soul gives radiance, it's because you shine in it. And if I love, it's because your love awakens it." John's God anticipates, initiates, gives, transforms like a flame entering till it engages the deepest desire, the deepest center. John's universe is drenched in a self-outpouring God. In his commentary on that poem, which he wrote under duress, but they all wanted it, so he did his best to do it, to unpack it, John of the Cross writes, "Where God is concerned, love is never idle. It's a continuous movement." And he also writes, "God's God's presence is like a song that's new, always new, wrapped around with joy and love. Permeating the commentary, writes he in Matthew, is an awareness of a self-communicating God. A God whose plan is to fill us with nothing less than God's self. The flame is a person. The flame of love. It's the spirit of the bridegroom, the breath of Christ. Maybe we could say the breathing of Christ. As we sound John's experience at its most authentic, we find this to be the reality that John knew. A God who is pressing in to give God's self to me, to you, to the world, to creation. I am yours, writes John of the Cross in his commentary. I'm yours, I'm for you. And I'm pleased to be as I am, that I may be yours and give myself to you. If you're seeking God, advises John of the Cross, know that much more is God seeking you. God's purpose, as John, is to make the soul great. When the deep caverns of the soul are empty and pure, the thirst and hunger and sense of spiritual longing is more than can be borne. The capacity of these caverns is deep, because that which they can hold is deep and infinite. It's God. So we're listening to John writing out of his experience and his understanding of that experience, which was very convincing then and remains so now. I'm purified so that I may receive what God is offering and respond and be in love. I may comment on that. Look at the words be in love, and then look at the word in English believe. Etymologically, believe means, from the Dutch I'm told, liefde, love. Believe means precisely to be in love, to put yourself in that love place, in that love that is actually surrounding us and permeating us and urging us and drawing us into communion. That's all happening. What a shame it would be to the extent that we're not aware of it. So, but the flame will of course purify, get rid of the stuff that's getting in the road. I have to do that so that I can then respond in love. John of the Cross, all, and this is possibly why we duck a bit and why we don't do it or something, because when we, if we allow it, all the soul's infirmities are brought to light. Who wants to see all your infirmities brought to light? But that's what happens, thank God. They are set before its eyes to be felt. Sin, whatever, to be felt and healed. Not avoided, not buried, not forgotten and moved on, but owned, learnt from, of course, but felt and therefore healed. Now, with the light and heat of the divine fire, continues John of the Cross, it sees, it, you, I, sees and feels those weaknesses and miseries which previously resided in it, hidden and unfelt, just as the dampness of the log of wood which you put on the fire was unknown until the fire was applied to it. And then the wood, the dampness, does all that. The dampness of the log was unknown till the fire was applied to it and made it sweat and smoke and sputter. This is what the flame does to the imperfect soul. And you'd have to say, thanks be to God, but there it is. The soul, John continues, is like the, there's a lovely image, the air within the flame. You can't actually see the flame of that candle in front of you, but we can all imagine flame easily. So the soul's like the air inside the flame. It's enkindled, transformed in the flame, for the flame is nothing but enkindled air. So we're surrounded by the flame of love, and we're in there, and it'll do all that flame does. John takes the time in his commentary to talk about meditation and contemplation. I'll just share with you what he says about meditation. For a better understanding of this beginner's stage, and it's not a bad idea to all of us to consider ourselves beginners, because we are. So, for a better understanding of this beginner's stage, it should be known that the practice of beginners is to meditate, to make acts and discursive reflections with the imagination. Those in this state should be given matter for meditation and discursive reflection, and they should, by themselves, make interior acts and profit in spiritual things from the delight and satisfaction of the senses. He gives examples, but let me just give some at random in a way. And most of us were trained in this, I would have thought. So we open a passage in Scripture, and it's about the blind man, let's say, at Jericho. So we watch it, and as we watch it, we're listening in here, which is what we do when we listen anyhow. We listen in here, and thoughts will come, feelings might come, they probably will. Different things will happen as we watch that blind man, and Jesus say, call him to me, and he gets up and runs to Jesus. And then we hear Jesus say something quite beautiful. He says, what would you like me to do for you? And he's asking all of us that question today easily. What would you like me to do for you? Because he's very loving. And the man says, I'd like to see again. Because he did see once, and then life caught up with him and he got distracted and missed it. Let me see again. And we're watching all that. And he's telling us, make interior acts and profit. So we're not watching it, excuse me, just to watch it. We're watching it to listen to what's happening in here as we watch. But then we do something else, maybe. Ignatius of Loyola would suggest this. We become the blind man now, because we are. All the gospel stories are about me, so they're all about you, aspects of us. So now we're the blind man. And we hear Jesus say, we cry out first, have pity on me, mercy. And then he says, come. So we run to him in our imagination, in our thoughts, prayer. And he then asks me now, me meaning you, of course, all of us, what do you want me to do for you? we say what it is. Or we might say, I don't know, but I just need something desperately because it's hopeless where I am. I don't know, whatever your answer is. You just give it, honestly. And then Jesus touches you and the rest. And then, this is not in Ignatius to the best of my knowledge, but it is, I think it's in the school of Beirut. And anyhow, it's a very ancient form of prayer, and I think it's quite lovely. The third part of the meditation that some traditions suggest is, in the third one, be Jesus. Same scene, but you be Jesus now. Because he did say, love one another as I have loved you. He is wanting to live in us. So you be Jesus. And then your mind might start filling with the people in your life. Your husband, your wife, your child, your parent, your grandkids, the teacher, I don't know, the neighbour. These people might come to your mind. People who actually are a bit blind. And they might be coming to you and you can make them a cup of tea and talk about the football finals, which you've all given up this weekend, which is pretty heroic, really. And I haven't yet decided whether I'll give up yet, because I do have a TV over there. But so if you want to come over and sit with me, you'd be welcome. Well, I won't tell on you. But anyhow, whatever you're giving up, or these people come to you. And can you? Is there someone in your life that you should can love more, can touch more, can be with more, can ring up? I don't know. But that's what your meditation is. I think that's what John's talking about here. I can't think of anything else. From the delight, and so it's you enjoy, hopefully, the prayer by being fed with the relish of spiritual things. The appetite is torn away from sensual things. We've got all these other pleasures, but this is closer to where we want to be, and it's weakened in regard to the things of the world. A little prayer would be in order. Then John goes to talk about something, you'd have to say, entirely different. Because all of us can do what I just said then, and what John says and what Ignatius says. We learned to do in the novitiate, some of us. We can all sit down, we can all read a passage of the night before we go to bed, and have it in our subconscious overnight, and we can all get up and we can all do exactly those three steps I've had, and it's prayer, and there are other methods of prayer that you know and you've been trained in and find joyful and real. So all of that we can do. But if we can do it, it's not contemplation. And I haven't got it here, but John, and Therese, but John particularly is a bit... I'll try and remember it. I won't remember it, but it's something like, he says, God, it's amazing. He says, people who've spent 2 hours in prayer, suddenly they reckon they've got the lot. They've met it, they're contemplating. And they say, God said this to me, and God said that to me, and John of the Cross says, it's nothing. They're wrong. They haven't got it right. So now let's get the real St. John. That's the one I remember. But here it is here. See what you think of it. When the appetite has been fed somewhat and has become, in a certain fashion, accustomed to spiritual things and has acquired some fortitude, discipline, constancy, God begins. There's no method of this. God begins to wean the soul and place it, God places it, you, in a state of contemplation. Some quickly accommodate their senses and appetites to God, and in their activity pass on to the spirit which God works in them. This happens when the soul's discursive acts and meditations cease. A dry up, you might say, as well as its initial sense of satisfaction and fervour. And it's unable to practice discursive meditation as before. It could still do it, but it's like performing something that's going nowhere and or they find any support for the senses. The sensory part is left in dryness, he tells us, because its riches are transferred to the spirit, which doesn't pertain to the senses, feelings, imagination, thoughts. It's not in that area at all. And now for an amazingly beautiful definition of contemplation, I think. Contemplation is nothing but a hidden, peaceful, loving inflow of God. If it's given room, and we're going to have a lot to say about that, that's what we can do. We can make the space for it. If it's given room, it will inflame the spirit with love. So as you know, you've probably all practiced, there are many practices, no doubt good, mantra, etc., whereby we can actually quieten down our body and our mind and our posture. We can do that, and it's good for the blood pressure, and it's good for everything, it's good for your health, and it's a good thing to do in general. So we can do all of that, but we can't contemplate. We can only make space for that other silence that only God can give. We should proceed only in this gift. We should proceed only with a loving attention to God, without making specific acts. We should conduct ourselves passively, not actively, passively, without efforts of our own, but with a simple, loving awareness, as with eyes open in loving attention. There's a lot written on this, but I don't know that anyone's written better than John of the Cross, but in any case, it's beautiful. And he goes on to say, when it happens that we're conscious of being placed in, not getting there, but being placed in solitude and in a state of listening, we should even forget the practice of loving attentiveness, so as to remain free for what the Lord then desires of us. We should make use of that loving attentiveness only when we don't feel ourselves placed in the solitude or inner idleness or oblivion or spiritual listening. And he's fumbling for words here, but I think we know what he's saying. And here's the key virtue that John of the Cross suggests in his commentary, trying to unpack the poem for us or alert us to the. And he's alerting 16th century Spaniards, so they're not going to be the same as us. But so they're beautiful in their own way, and so are we. So he's not writing for me, he's writing for them. But he says, you shouldn't bear being attached to anything. Or as he just said, not even to being lovingly attentive, or to a method of prayer that takes you into a silence that's not contemplation. You should not bear being attached to anything, whether it be to the practice of meditation or to anything, whether sensory or spiritual, which delights you or any way of thinking, attached to it. I remember reading once, I hope it's not a distraction, I don't think it is. It's just a story, no doubt it happens, and you dads among you all know this. Dad was there with a little kid who's just walking, let's say two, something like that, at the beach. And Dad's sitting on the verge of the grass, and then there's sand, and then there's the water, the sea, and it's all safe, and it's gentle. and the little child is going out picking up shells. There must have been a time when you could actually find a lovely shell. I've looked all my life and never found one. Have I just stopped being there or what? Anyhow, this little kid picks up, when he's picked up a really lovely one, he'd run back to Dad and with great joy, and he'd go and pick up another one, and eventually, you know, he had quite a little pile of them. And then they saw, I don't know who saw it first in the story, they saw a starfish, gold red thing. It's just stunning in the shallow water. And the little boy goes down, and he wasn't frightened of shallow water, and he went down and got to the edge of the water, and then he came back to Dad. And Dad, what the problem was? So he said, go on, you'll be okay. So he went again, and he went into the water a little way, and then he came back to Dad, looking almost crying, you know. So he had a third go, and the dad said, darling, what's the problem? And the little boy held out his hands. They were full of shells. He would have had to let the shells go to pick up what he really wanted. And he couldn't let them go. Simple little story, but do you recognize yourself in any of that? We shouldn't be attached to anything. Teresa of Lisieux said, when I go to heaven, I want to go with open hands. Have everything. We're talking about what you have, but it's being attached, possessed by them. You shouldn't bear being attached to anything, whether it be this or that or whatever. Anything upon which you may lean would impede and disquiet you and make noise in the profound silence of your senses and your spirit, which you possess. Why? For the sake of this deep and delicate listening. So, is he telling me and you to get in touch with our deepest longings, which can easily be distracted by? We can have hands full of things that are good, but they might be getting in the road of what we really want. Is not my word like a fire, says Yahweh? There again we have the pierced heart of Christ on the cross, offering us his life, his prayer, his spirit, his patience, his longing, his agenda, his mission. It's all coming from his heart to when the church is born out of that pierced heart. And I'll finish by playing this music to you again.